From Audioboom comes Mafia, a brand new podcast taking us into America's criminal underworld, exploring the lives and careers of the most powerful gangsters the world has ever seen. Through extensive research and eyewitness stories, Mafia reveals what life was really like inside the mob from the people who lived it. Every Wednesday, Mafia dives into the larger-than-life stories of mobsters and introduces us to the key figures who brought them down. In Season 1, host Fleet Copper will bring us closer than ever to the most notorious mob bosses of all time by taking us inside the lives of Sam Giancana, Dutch Schultz, Bugsy Siegel, Charles Lucky Luciano, John Gotti, and Donnie Brasco, discovering how they built their criminal enterprises and revealing how the Mafia is connected to the assassination of JFK. Subscribe to Mafia on Apple Podcasts and every other listening destination. Hello, my name is Ali and you are listening to Insight. Here with me, looking from out my computer screen, is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you tonight?
I'm doing well. I'm enjoying the last few weeks of summer, but secretly, I need the colder weather back. It makes me far more productive.
Your idea of cold weather and my idea of cold weather are two different things. But yeah, I would love your cold weather. That would be fantastic.
And for those who may have missed it or who aren't in our Facebook group, we are currently running a poll for listeners to choose the cases for both our 100th episode and our second birthday episode. There are some very interesting cases there, like the Greenlease kidnapping, Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler, and the Crawford family murders. So vote away. I think voting is open for one more week. And this year's Crime Con is fast approaching. On the weekend of May 4 to 6 in Nashville, Tennessee, we'll be appearing among some of our favourite podcasters on Podcast Row, such as The Vanish, Generation Y, The Trail Went Cold, and Minds of Madness. And CrimeCon has given us an exclusive code for 10% off all standard tickets. Use code INSIGHT at checkout at crimecon.com and we'll see you there. Before we begin on this week's episode, this case deals with a graphic murder that we will discuss aspects of. It may not be for everyone, and some people may find parts of this episode distressing, so listener discretion is advised. This week, though, we are discussing the 2014 double murder of Russell and Shirley Dermond. Russell was found in their Lake Oconee waterfront property decapitated, and his wife was missing. Shirley was found almost 2 weeks later, floating in the lake by two fishermen and bludgeoned to death. How the killer or killers got into the home is something that has baffled investigators for the past almost 4 years, because no one saw or heard anything. They lived in a gated community with a 24 hours a day security guard, and there is no apparent motive. 88-year-old Russell Dermond and his wife, 87-year-old Shirley Dermond, were married for 68 years, and they settled in Georgia to live out their retirement on the shores of Lake Oconee. They were in a gated resort community known as the Great Lakes, and it's about 75 miles east of Atlanta. You will also see this case called the Lake Oconee Murders or the Murders at the Great Lakes. The surrounding area is residence to Indigenous persons ranging from lower to middle class. It also has an affluent population of retirees and vacation homes for the wealthy. Lake Oconee spans nearly 30 miles across three counties with beaches and almost a dozen boat marinas. Lake Oconee was originally built in 1979. And it's surrounded by the Jack Nicklaus Golf Course on one side and the Great Lakes community on the other.
Russell and Shirley resided in an almost million-dollar home in Putnam County that was over 3,300 square feet, and it had its own private dock on the lake. So you can imagine this was plenty of room for an elderly couple to just enjoy their retirement and relax.
And if you saw the preview video for this episode, you'll see a picture of the house. It's a massive house. It's beautiful, looks isolated. It's a place you want to live out your retirement.
While not extremely wealthy, the Dermans had done well for themselves. Russell had worked as an executive for a clock company, and he had later run a chain of Hardee's restaurants in Atlanta for more than 10 years. He was a U.S. Navy veteran, but his hobbies were less high pressure than you would expect for someone who was an executive and ran restaurants and was in the Navy. He liked relaxing walks. He liked golfing, going to the movies, dining with friends, and just reading. His wife, Shirley, was an avid bridge player, and they both attended the Lake Oconee Community Church, where they were known as humble and sweet, and they were very proud of their family. And on top of this, they had no known enemies. They left good impressions wherever they went. People liked them, but this quiet life wasn't without some tragedy. They lost their eldest son, Mark, to a drug-related murder in 2000, and we will discuss that in more detail later. But Russell and Shirley were spending most of their days just at peace, enjoying the community. This community, this lifestyle, it matched what they really wanted. The crime was low, especially within their exclusive neighborhood, where there was the guard at the gate, and all the guests and workers were recorded. Guest passes were given, so there was an element and a feel of safety and just security in that neighborhood. And the neighbors were not just friendly with each other, but they were close friends with each other. And in fact, Russell and Shirley were set to attend a Kentucky Derby party with their neighbors, a married couple that they knew very well, on Sunday, May 3rd, 2014. But Shirley wasn't seen after a bridge club on May 1st, and Russell was last seen at the grocery store doing his regular shopping, filling his prescriptions at the pharmacy, cashing a check at the bank, and then golfing on the 2nd. They did not make it to the party the following day for the 3rd.
On May 6, 2014, after several failed attempts to reach the Dermans by phone, these neighbours who lived a little over a mile away, and these were the Dermans' only neighbours, the Dermans lived at the end of a cul-de-sac. And a third of the residents in this community, they weren't permanent residents. They were only used as vacation homes. But these neighbours went over to the Dermans' residence to check on them. In the driveway, they found several days' worth of newspapers, as well as mail from the 3rd still being in the mailbox. But when they opened the garage door, both cars were still inside, so they assumed the Dermans were at home. To the neighbour's surprise, the front door was unlocked, and the interior of the house was quiet, spotless, and in order. That's with the exception of an unmade bed and a crooked lampshade in the living room. But this wasn't unusual. The Dermans were extremely house proud and kept the house immaculate. I did read in one interview with the neighbours who said, quote unquote, you could eat your food off their floor. The neighbours also found the Dermans' key and cell phones still in the house, along with a half-finished crossword from May 2nd's newspaper. Then, in the garage in between a Lexus SUV and a Lincoln Town Car, the neighbours walked down 3 steps and found a pool of dried blood. And then they saw the body of Russell Dermond. Though at the time, they couldn't be certain because his head was missing and nowhere to be found. A more thorough panic search of the house could not locate Shirley Dermond either. Due to drag marks near Russell's body, the police knew Shirley wasn't capable of committing such a heinous crime, but she was missing and likely in great danger. We just need to take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Brooklinen.
Something I never thought I'd be able to say. I have become a bedsheet evangelist. I was on social media the other day and one of my friends just posted a quick question. What thread count should I look for quality sheets? I had to jump in and tell her about brooklinen.com. If you go on their website, they explain what goes into making high quality sheets beyond just thread count. Brooklinen's philosophy is simple: beautiful home essentials without the crazy prices. There's no unnecessary markups and fees. Most bedding out there is marked up as much as 300%. With versatile colors and patterns, you can mix and match your Brooklinen sheets to complement any decor. This is luxury bedding underpriced, and you have to try these sheets today. Obviously, I love my Brooklinen sheets. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. The only way to get the $20 off and the free shipping is to use promo code SITE at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code SITE. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. So this sudden violence at the Derman residence shocked and horrified, as you can imagine, both neighbors, but also the law enforcement in Putnam County. In addition to having no major physical or mental health concerns, Russell and Shirley lived a quiet and undisturbed life. They were happy, they were well-liked within the close community. At the height of the investigation, 14 FBI agents and 60 sheriff deputies interviewed 200, 225 people. The number varies depending on who you ask. But no neighbors heard any struggle or calls of distress that would indicate that the couple was in trouble. The house was immaculate, save for what was discovered in the garage. To add to the strangeness, one of the Derman sons, Keith, said that his mother and father were quote-unquote religious about locking their doors and turning on the home security system. The Dermans had a home security system, but it wasn't activated for whatever reason on the day of the crime. For that reason, Keith believes the crimes took place during the day. But a murder and a presumed abduction in broad daylight in a safe, gated community with no evidence or witnesses seemed far-fetched to the residents and to the investigators. Sheriff Howard Sills and his deputies in the Putnam County Sheriff's Office checked the subdivision's guardhouse, hoping the security footage captured something. Because at the front gate, there were two security cameras. However, in an unfortunate coincidence, a recent lightning storm about 3 weeks before the crimes damaged the cameras and blew out the entire computer system that worked with the cameras. They hadn't been working for at least a few days before the crime, if not longer. So if the killer or killers had somehow gone past the security guards and drove to the Derman home, there was no visual evidence of it.
A massive search was conducted under the pretense that Shirley may have been abducted. But the truth is, from what I could find in articles and interviews with the sheriff, any hope of finding her alive was short-lived. And as the days turned into weeks, investigators knew that this was most likely going to be a double homicide situation. Divers used the most high-tech equipment available to search every inch of the lake and nearby cove. And I've had interviews with Sheriff Sills, and he said the lake was also dragged with drag hooks. So any piece of evidence, no matter how small, could have been recovered, but they found nothing. And as far as investigations and searches go, this was thorough. They brought in cadaver dogs. They even traced Russell Derman's last steps, right down to what groceries he bought that day. They looked at CCTV footage of Russell going into the grocery store on the last day he was seen alive. They looked at CCTV footage of everything he did that day. the grocery store, the pharmacy and the bank and the golf course. And then 10 days later, on May 16, 5 miles away from the Dermond home by water on Lake Oconee, two fishermen noticed a body floating face down on the lake surface. Police identified the body as Shirley Dermond. They determined that she would have died sometime on May 2nd or May 3rd, the same time as her husband. And with Russell, the medical examiner was able to determine the date due to the level of decomposition not being as advanced as it normally would have been 4 days after, because the air conditioning in the garage was still turned on. The date of death was also supported with Russell accessing and sending emails on May 2nd and Shirley completing the crossword puzzle in the May 2nd newspaper. Her family later reported that their mother always did the crossword puzzle on the same day she received the newspaper.
Cause of death was determined to have been due to blunt force trauma to the head. The medical examiner stated in his report that Shirley would have been hit one or two times, crushing her skull. Her killers dumped her body in the lake post-mortem and attached it to 2 30-pound or 13.5-kilogram cinder blocks inside a mesh bag, and they tied that to her feet, all in an attempt to conceal the evidence. What the killers failed to account for is the decomposing gases that cause weighted down bodies to become more buoyant and that caused Shirley's body to rise to the surface. But what this discovery did tell investigators is that it was entirely possible that the killer or killers gained access to the Dermond's property via the private dock on a boat instead of in a car. We know that the killer or killers had access to this boat because where Shirley was recovered, there was no way they could have accessed that part of the lake by foot or by car. She would have had to have been disposed of on a boat. It also told investigators that while there was no effort to hide Russell's body, the killer or killers did not want Shirley's body to be found for some reason. We also know that their son's first instinct that this happened during the middle of the day was pretty likely. Shirley was found wearing her normal day clothes. She was wearing a shirt, she was slacks, and she even had her shoes on. This happened not in the middle of the night where she would have been in night clothes, but happened at some point after Shirley had gotten up and had gotten ready to go about her day.
Russell was also beaten, but because there were no fatal wounds on his body, the medical examiner concluded Russell died the same way as his wife, due to blunt force trauma to the head. The medical examiner concluded the decapitation was done post-mortem, which was evident due to the blood. When decapitation is done prior to death, as we see in cases of terrorism, the blood residue is greater due to the blood flow. But when it happens post-mortem, the only blood residue is whatever was currently present at the time of the decapitation. The medical examiner also determined that it was not done with surgical precision, but it was something the killer or killers took their time doing. The only other wounds evident on Russell Dermond was small cuts on one of his hands that may have been defensive wounds of some sort. And the profile of the killer or killers, we can learn a lot from the method used here, the decapitation. The investigators do strongly believe these murders were committed by two different killers because of the very different methods used here, and they are very different. Russell was decapitated and Shirley was disposed of in the lake. One method really left a message. Usually the psychology behind decapitation is to send a message to create a theatrical display and for shock value, that the killer wants to show they have no respect for the victim, that it's not enough just to murder them. The killer wants everyone to see in graphic detail what they have done. There is definitely a sense of power there. where disposing of Shirley showed the killer didn't want their crime to be discovered, that they wanted to hide what they had done for some reason, whether it was because they didn't want to risk being caught or because there was some kind of evidence they were worried would be found. Even though we know that wasn't the case in this crime, the killer or killers weren't concerned that Russell was going to be found and probably not very long after being left out in the open in his home. But Shirley was weighed down and disposed of in the middle of the lake, away from home, and there would have been a chance that she wouldn't be discovered.
Like Ali said, because of the scope of the crime and the decapitation, Sheriff Sills believed there was more than one individual responsible for the murders. But there's a big question here. Where's the evidence? There were no witness sightings. Nothing was heard out of the ordinary. And polygraph testing on all of the subdivision's maintenance personnel turned up nothing. Searches of the lake and the surrounding woods left the authorities empty-handed. The only items missing from the home was Shirley and her husband's head, which there was no trace of. What would have been the most frustrating for investigators was there was no clear motive for the murder. The family had no known enemies, and there was a lack of forced entry that indicated that maybe the Dermans knew their attacker or attackers and had let them in. The Derman children were ruled out as suspects. Let's put that out there. They were the only people to financially benefit from these deaths, so obviously they had to be investigated. And I imagine this had to have been, in their grief, extremely painful for them, but I'm sure they understood why. The police had to go through the three adult children's cell phone records, which included the cell towers that the calls were pinging off of that weekend. And none of these calls were even in the state of Georgia, let alone anywhere near the area. Investigators went further and confirmed their alibis for the weekends on the murders, and the three adult children were all polygraphed. Of course, they passed their polygraphs. Nothing in the investigation revealed any evidence of animosity towards their parents, so through a combination of all of this, they were ruled out as suspects. So who would have wanted this elderly couple not only dead, but in such a brutal and heinous way?
Eventually, there was one report of a man spotted on the Derman's lawn around the time of the murders, but no description has ever been released to the public. And while Sheriff Sills considers him a person of interest, there hasn't been any other information released about him. The only other suspect they have ever had was in early 2015, a person of interest who hasn't been publicly named. It was revealed that this person of interest had not been truthful with law enforcement, but as of the recording of this episode, they are currently not considered an official suspect, and there has been no announced development since. And then in 2016, a 34-year-old man was arrested in the same neighbourhood for slashing tyres with a large knife. Ryan Oliver Reed was arrested and charged with vandalism, and he did have priors for similar crimes. But Sheriff Sills declared him not a suspect in the Derman murders, and I think I'd have to agree here. Honestly, I don't think we're looking at some small-time petty criminal here. Whoever is responsible for the Derman murders was smart enough not to leave behind any trace of themselves at the scene, and there really isn't anything that is stopping Sheriff Sills from releasing everything to the public. Under Georgia's open records law, law enforcement doesn't have to keep anything to themselves like we see in other cases. But I do imagine in this case it is possible investigators looked into all these leads and possibly cleared them of suspicion. And that would explain why we haven't heard anything more and why we don't have a detailed description of the man on the lawn. But back in December 9, 2014, Sheriff Sills told a television reporter that the Sheriff's Department received thousands of pages of phone records going back 6 months prior to Russell and Shirley's murders. And they used special software to help investigators analyse these phone records to see if there was anything unusual, anything that would suggest a suspect. But investigators found no new leads there either.
Early on, when obviously before they found Shirley's body, they had to entertain the idea that maybe Shirley was involved. And neighbors were interviewed by the media and did wonder if there was any way she could be involved. But like Ellie said pretty early on in this episode, that the authorities didn't think she would have been capable of dragging Russell's body across the garage floor, and they had seen those drag marks. But there's also no evidence that Shirley had anything but love for her husband. By all accounts, everyone who knew them, they had a happy marriage, and there was nothing untoward going on.
The next theory is that somehow the couple's murders were related to their son's Mark's death back in 2000. To say that Mark Dermond had a drug problem would be probably understating it. He was struggling with life. He would steal jewelry from his mother, forge checks, all of which progressed to him committing a robbery in New York, which he ended up doing time for. Mark would constantly do these things and his parents would be there to bail him out of trouble. They even paid for several stints in rehab. And then on August 30 of 2000, on Mark's 47th birthday, he and a friend made arrangements to buy cocaine from a man named Troy Major. But what Mark and his friend didn't know was that Major was not a drug dealer, but he robbed people who thought they were going to buy drugs. Mark and his friend pulled up to make the exchange, and Major opened fire on both of them. Mark was shot in the throat and chest and died, but his friend survived the attack. Russell and Shirley did not attend the trial for their son's murder. On November 9, 2001, Troy Major was sentenced to life in prison for malice murder, on top of 20 years for aggravated assault and 5 years for possession of a firearm during the commission of a felony. And despite numerous attempts to appeal his sentence, up to the recording of this episode, all attempts to appeal have been denied every time. Firstly, his motions for appeal were denied by the state Supreme Court on April 5, 2005, and again July 13, 2006. And this was partly due to, even though the Dermonds didn't attend the murder trial, they did write numerous letters to the parole board pleading them not to release Major. And because of this, some believe there is a connection here, although there really isn't any evidence to support this, and law enforcement have no reason to believe the two are related.
There are some rumors that Russell Dermond was part of the witness protection program because of some connection with the mafia. And that's what this third theory mostly revolves around. This connection is what made him and his wife a target and was ultimately responsible for the murders. However, Sheriff Sills has been adamant during interviews with the media that there is no way, no how, that Russell and Shirley were in any witness protection programs. And as we've said before, there were no known enemies, let alone mobsters. The witness protection angle would not make sense considering the whole family's names were on public record. The identities of their children were known. The Dermond's children visited them on a regular basis. There's really no reason to think that this was some sort of assassination by organized crime, but that doesn't mean the murder wasn't premeditated, considering the killers got past the security guard without attracting unwanted attention, by car, but most likely boat through the private dock. The fact that they went undetected by any of the neighbors and they cleaned up all of the evidence at the Dermond house, except for Russell's body, not just blood evidence, but investigators weren't able to find any forensic evidence at all. And it all leads to the thought process that this was premeditated and thought through meticulously before the murders took place.
And the next theory flows on from that idea process. And because it was so very well planned and because it does seem like a premeditated murder, that perhaps these murders were the work of a serial killer. And this could be why the murders seemed void of a clear motive. There was a very similar murder of an 83-year-old woman named Lois Colley in New York following the Dermans' death. On November 13, 2015, Lois was bludgeoned to death, and Lois also made her wealth from fast food restaurants, leading to the belief that there could be a connection between her death and the Dermans. The only thing missing from Lois's home was a fire extinguisher, similar to the Dermans' murder, where there was nothing missing. However, Putnam County and New York State Police agreed that the deaths likely had no connection. Now, Shirley Derman originally came from New York City. She grew up there and lived there until she graduated from college. And their son, Mark, did spend some time living there. As I said before, he was arrested there for robbery. But other than that, there is nothing to tie the Dermans to New York or Lois Colley's murder.
Finally, there is the theory that the murder was the result of a botched robbery or an extortion plot. Sheriff Sills speculates that the couple may have been threatened for money or for valuables and either couldn't or wouldn't provide what was asked for and ended up being killed because of it. This is further supported by the fact that they had been extorted before. In the fall of 2012, Russell and Shirley were the victims of identity theft. Over 4 days, more than $2,000 over 9 different transactions were charged to the Dermans' credit card, and the perpetrators were never caught. Sheriff Sills also said it's possible Russell's head was taken to prevent the identification of a firearm that could have been used as the murder weapon to kill Russell by a shot to the head. However, without locating Russell's head, there's no evidence that can fully confirm this. But, I mean, it is a chance that this is the case. The lack of evidence and witness reports, that's the most frustrating aspect of this. There's just a lack of evidence left behind by the killer or the killers, even though this crime was extremely brutal, and there are just so many unanswered questions here.
As of 2017, the Putnam County Sheriff's Office continues to work on the case. And from what I can find in contemporary news articles about the case, Sheriff Sills shows no signs of stopping until it's solved. Sheriff Sills, who has over 40 years of law enforcement experience, he says that any lead that comes in is followed up on, regardless of how far-fetched it may seem at the time. As we said, the FBI are also involved in the case, and they also believe this wasn't a random attack, that the Dermans were specifically targeted.
So earlier on, we talked a little bit about the profile of the killers, and there was a lot made of Russell's missing head and what that message that sent that the killers felt about him. Honestly, I'm with Sheriff Sills here. I think both the head being missing and Shirley's body being left in the water, I think both of those were forensic countermeasures to prevent identification. I think this was cold-blooded. I think this was targeted. The cleanliness of this does feel like it was a professional, not a first-timer's job. So I don't know the motive, but I definitely see why people think it was some kind of organized crime type hit put out on them. But I mean, an elderly couple who plays bridge and goes for long walks and reads and plays crossword puzzles. I mean, what could possibly be the motive here? I don't know, but to me, this is very clearly some type of hit.
Personally, I think whoever killed the Dermans knew them well. The fact that nothing was taken immediately arouses suspicion for me. I think someone who was close to them, and presumably others knew them as well, they would know that anything in the house would have been stolen, like expensive furniture or jewelry, could have been immediately traced back to the Dermans, and then hence we would know who did the crime. Also, the fact that Russell's head was removed, I think it does show that someone wanted to conceal his cause of death. It could have been they had some kind of rare gun that they weren't planning on using and it did go off. To me, I think that leaves two possible solutions. I think there's a chance that the killer's only motivation was the murder itself. And this solution would fit with someone who didn't want money. They just wanted the Germans dead out of spite. Maybe it was someone who felt severely wronged by the Germans in some way. Or secondly, the killer wanted to extort the Germans and something went wrong. Russell's body did show signs of a struggle. Maybe someone was trying to kidnap Shirley and he fought back trying to save her. If he was killed somehow during the fight, an extortion charge becomes a murder charge. And with one murder already on their hands, maybe the killer decided to kill Shirley too because she couldn't identify them then. The house Russell and Shirley lived in was sold in April of 2015 for $650,000, almost a year after the murders. And the three adult German children were so haunted by their parents' deaths, they felt they couldn't carry out their final wishes to be cremated and have their ashes spread over Lake Oconee, which honestly I can understand given what happened so close to that spot, and that's where their mother was finally found. Their son Keith mentioned in one newspaper article that we almost don't feel that it's appropriate anymore. We just don't know what to do. The family and law enforcement haven't given up that justice can still be done. A reward of $55,000 is being offered for information leading to the apprehension of the person or persons responsible for the murders of Russell and Shirley Dermond. Sheriff Sills believes that all it will take is one tip from a witness or someone who might know something that will likely solve this horrible crime. Anyone with information should contact Sheriff Sills at the Putnam County Sheriff's Department on 706 485 8557. This information will also be available on this episode's show notes and on our website. Turn off the lights, get into bed, and plug in your earphones. It's time for a creepy bedtime story. For those 14 at heart, we cover anything that is remotely strange. From the paranormal to the supernatural, unsolved mysteries, strange deaths, conspiracy theories, cryptids, and everything in between. All told in a unique and creepy way. Beyond Your Nightmares is a production of Insight Podcasts. Listen to Beyond Your Nightmares from February 23rd on iTunes or your favourite podcast app.